listeners. Welcome to Carry the One Radio, the science podcast. I'm Maggie, and I'm here with an exciting interview we conducted as a part of the collaboration with the Institute of Global Health Science at UCSF. This is the first of another Global Health in the Time of COVID mini-series, where we speak to health experts at UCSF to learn more about them, their work, and how the COVID-19 pandemic has changed their practice and research. In this episode, we talk about a subject that almost all of us are newly familiar with, contact tracing. CTOR executive producer Ben Mansky spoke to Ramses Escobedo, Jess Celentano, and Mike Reed in September of last year about their newfound roles as contact tracers, what contact tracing entails, how it's been conducted in San Francisco, challenges in the process, and their ideas for how to fix these issues. Stay tuned.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Just to start off, could each of you give me a quick introduction, your name, your title or position, and what institution you're affiliated with?
My name is Ramses Escobedo. Well, currently I'm a contact tracer team lead with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. On my day job though, I'm a librarian, I'm a branch manager. I manage the Excelsior branch in San Francisco.
I'm Jess Celentano, and in my previous life, I was the deputy director of the Center for Global Health Delivery, Diplomacy, and Economics. That's a part of the Institute for Global Health Sciences at UCSF. And in my current life, I co-direct the contact tracing team in close collaboration with the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
Mike?
So in my pre-COVID life, I am an infectious disease doctor and work with Jess in the Center for Global Health Diplomacy and Delivery, doing hand-wavy policy analysis related to tuberculosis, HIV, etc. And now I help sort of coordinate and provide sort of subject matter expertise in contact tracing for San Francisco Department of Public Health, and then help run the California-wide contact tracing program in collaboration with California Department of Public Health.
Well, thank you all for taking the time to talk. I'm sure you're all incredibly busy right now, but I think this is a really important thing that honestly not many people understand too much. What exactly is like contact tracing? What would you say that the term itself encompasses? And then maybe what does it actually look like to do it when you're on the proverbial ground?
So the main role is to contact individuals which were in close contact with the confirmed positive case of COVID-19 virus. And then we connect them with the appropriate resources, whether that's like a testing site, isolation and quarantine units in case they can't quarantine on their own or isolate on their own, food assistance, cleaning, housing services, like supplies, like mental health access, even pets needs, prescription drugs, and other miscellaneous needs, such as like if somebody needs help with errands or picking up groceries, and also emotional support. That's the main scope of it. But I think we do a little more than that. We do not only do what I just mentioned, but we're able to listen to them, to offer an empathetic ear, to provide moral support and alleviate some of the concerns they have. And we show that we care and we're there for them during their time of need.
That's pretty amazing. That's also significantly more than I think I realized goes into contact tracing. Mike, you had something you wanted to add?
Well, I mean, I think Ramses has sort of eloquently described what we do. The frame for this from an epidemiological point of view is important, though. So we know that the virus that causes COVID has a profound proclivity for spread, as I mentioned before. And there's this term, the reproductive number, that you may be familiar with, which is the number of individuals in a susceptible population that can be infected by somebody who has COVID or any other disease. And so for COVID, we know that that number is between 2.5 and 3, which means that over 10 rounds of replication, somebody with COVID could potentially lead to 59,000 other people being infected. So exactly what Ramsey said, if you can reach out to those cases and say, hey, you need to isolate so that you don't transmit the virus to anybody else. And if you can reach out to all of their close contacts, the people at greatest risk for transmission, and say, hey, you need to stay at home, you need to quarantine, then that's our best way of preventing that onwards transmission. To Ramsey's point, like, you can't expect anybody to isolate or quarantine without providing them with the resources to do that, right? You know, and particularly given that we know that this is a virus that disproportionately affects the economically disenfranchised, the socially marginalized, the most vulnerable members of our community. So providing those wraparound services that Ramsey mentioned, being that sort of compassionate ear on the phone, is absolutely critical.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, kind of just emphasize a couple points that I've now had the pleasure of speaking to so many of our contact tracers, doing interviews on a weekly basis, checking in with them, really getting to understand the workforce. And there's just so much that surprises us about contact tracing. I think, you know, it does sit in this like epi frame, and it's a public health response, but it's like a community response too. And the amount that people feel appreciative and really open to talking, and, you know, that it's not just our team, as Ramses said, that's calling to talk, they're calling to listen, as one of our colleagues pointed out. And the amount of love that comes back to us from the community saying, like, thank you, no one has ever done something like this for me. Feels like the city really is doing their part in looking after me. Like, that means so much to me. One of our tracers called it a mutual appreciation fest, where the tracer says, thank you, and then the contact says, no, thank you.
Something that had just occurred to me as you all were introducing yourselves was, for how long have you all been sort of shifted into these new roles? How long was it between everything getting shut down and contact tracing programs springing up?
The libraries closed mid-March, and by mid-April, I had been recruited by Jess to join the program.
So it's hard to remember, Ben, but I think if my memory serves me correctly, in about late February, early March, our team had started to kind of gain traction in a collaboration with SFDPH, much in part to Mike's kind of legwork with the team, kind of demonstrating that a group of us from IGHS had some skills to offer. So a group of us in mid-March kind of took on the role of just doing contact tracing. All kind of people who had worked in global health, had backgrounds in public health, and kind of understood what contact tracing was, but didn't really know the ins and outs of it. And since March have kind of grown from just people piecing scopes of work and standard operating procedures together to running a platform that has, you know, over 200 people involved in it now.
Quite early on, I was asked to help out at the public health, even before shelter in place, while this was just kind of emerging. I think I had a sort of a useful role in highlighting the need that the Department of Public Health had for experts who knew how to rapidly scale programs. And the Institute for Global Health Sciences is unique in San Francisco insofar as, like, it, you know, it's a bunch of people that do that for a living. And there was a recognition that if we were to respond to COVID in San Francisco, one of the things we needed to do was to implement a contact tracing program of a scale and magnitude not previously, you know, seen.
Yeah, it sounds like you were on it maybe unsurprisingly earlier than a lot of what the general public has been thinking of as the critical period for when COVID started really picking up.
I mean, I think that reflects a couple of things. One is that you know, in San Francisco, there was fairly decisive leadership very early on from the mayor and the director of the Department of Public Health, recognizing that emergency measures were needed. And so contact tracing was up and running right from the get-go. Like, even those first cases, March 5th, I think, was the first San Francisco case, was appropriately contact traced, because I think people realized, holy shit, this is a disease that moves fast. We looked at like other parts of the world and how they were already responding. So in Wuhan, China, they mobilized I think 11,000 contact traces for a population of 8-9 million. And we were like, well, if we're going to replicate anything of that sort of robustness and magnitude, then we need to think in terms of a scale that was much bigger than had previously been imagined.
It's really just about connection and doing what we can in a landscape that feels like there's not much to do. It really changes that up, I think.
Yeah. Obviously, there's a lot of work that goes into making this sort of the community-based process that it is. Would you say that at the start, there was this same feeling, or do you think it's grown sort of as you've developed the program together?
I think so much has grown out of this. Like, I would never would have known back in March what this community would be capable of. And also that, you know, it wasn't just about mobilizing a bunch of disaster service workers, a bunch of people in public health. It was about kind of creating a moment in time for people to provide in a time when it felt like you couldn't do anything and that you were isolated and that you were alone. This has really provided, I think, by and large, an opportunity for people to feel useful. And we definitely capitalize on that as a team to keep people going. Because the other side of the beautiful mutual appreciation fest is that this work is extremely hard and that it does take a emotional and physical and mental toll on the people that do it day in and day out. So with the rosy picture, with the lovey feelings that I'm giving out, I also want to really highlight that, you know, we don't take for granted like the amount of energy that this takes from our workforce.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, there's a lot of appreciation, mutual appreciation, but there is a toll. It's taxing mentally, physically, and emotionally, you know, but at the same time, the level of satisfaction and pride that contact tracers feel doing this job and serving the community and bonding with them, because it is a bonding experience, far, far outweighs any negative aspects of the job. And we're all just happy and advocating to remain here until we have completely halted the spread of the virus and defeated it.
I'd imagine it's really important to keep in mind while doing this work, sort of look at the big picture. I wanted to ask sort of how are you measuring how you're doing with your contact tracing work, and what does sort of like the ideal outcome look like, at least in the San Francisco scale?
There are a few metrics that we're looking at, and the ones that like are on the website that you can look at are proportion of cases that we're reaching and recommending for isolation, and then the proportion of close contacts of cases that we're reaching that we're recommending quarantine. The targets in our site is that we reach 90% of cases in San Francisco, reach them and recommend that they isolate, and then of their contacts, we reach 90% of them. I think the other piece to sort of Ramsey's point earlier is thinking through a health equity lens. We're very focused on trying to reach those communities that have been most impacted. So in San Francisco, that's the Latinx community. And we can look at that based on whether an individual identifies as Hispanic or Latinx and based on their language preference and whether we're effectively reaching them with somebody who speaks the same language. Because we're really keen to ensure that the contact tracer is speaking the same language as the individual to sort of minimize the microaggressions that come from like using a translator service or not being able to communicate effectively.
Yeah. Definitely. And about how many, I guess, contact tracers have been mobilized at this point in the city?
So we have over 200, but we have a lot of people working at, you know, different levels of effort. And these are people who are disaster service workers. So they're from the library, the city attorney's office, the assessor's office, you know, tax collectors, public defenders. We have students from UCSF Med School, from CCSF, from San Francisco State. We have, you know, folks from IGHS, and we have, you know, several people from the Department of Public Health. And then very importantly, we have mobilized community-based organizations as part of our CI and CT workforce. So it's a massive endeavor.
We've talked a little bit about the things that are required to make a contact tracing interaction supportive and successful. I guess what are some potentials or barriers to reaching contacts or making that a successful sort of interaction that does build community?
Well, I mean, it depends on the household for sure and their background. Obviously, I'm a Spanish-speaking contact tracer, and with Hispanic, with Latino families, there are a lot of areas. Obviously, one of the main ones is language, right? But we have recruited a lot of Spanish-speaking contact tracers. Additionally, we have transiting service at our disposal every day. But from the household perspective, from the families, you know, they're afraid of their immigration status that may be questioned. Obviously, the language. Sometimes there's a little bit of ignorance in regards of what COVID-19 is and how it affects and you, and or a little reluctance. I think that's a little more kind of cultural. One of the issues that I have encountered when speaking to, especially the person who earns that income at home, that, you know, they're the only person earning, and that they feel that if they're asked to stay at home, they won't be able to provide for their families. So there's a lot of education going on in these calls about the resources available and about what the employers must do to allow employees to stay safely at home and ride out the potential infection or the actual infection. Those are some of the things I've encountered. The vast majority of calls that I've made, or now that my team makes, people are really receptive to our guidelines and our attempts to help. And additionally, they're always willing to provide even more information, like identifying other potential close contacts, etc.
If there was another sort of secret to our success, is sort of a recognition of the importance of training around cultural humility and helping people to understand the implicit biases that they bring into all of their engagements, but particularly around contact tracing, so that when we're reaching people, we're client-centered, we're sort of empowerment-based.
Definitely. The health system isn't known for having the best record in terms of cultural humility, so it's, I think, really cool and very important that this is an integral part of the contact tracing process.
This is one thing which I think is really exciting about this unfortunate, tragic moment in our society. I think for a moment, we have an opportunity to kind of rethink how we deliver healthcare in a way that addresses structural violence and the profound inequities that COVID has sort of shone a light on. And I think our lofty, optimistic vision is that contact tracing can, in some ways, be a catalyst for more transformative change within our health system.
What an incredible time to have like a whole new influx of enthusiasm and excitement into the field of public health and people feeling like it's not a specialized skill. It's actually something that like everyone has within them and the ability to like contribute to public health from where they stand. It's pretty cool.
This relates to something that had actually come up earlier is I don't think I would guess many of our listeners aren't aware of sort of what it means to be a disaster worker or someone who sort of gets tapped in the case of something like this. What exactly does that mean? And who falls under that category?
You know, at the start of the epidemic, there were many civil servants that were furloughed because they couldn't do their work, you know, from across city government, not just in San Francisco, but across the state and nation. And so what the city sought to do was try and mobilize some of the, you know, those folks that were willing to do this work because they couldn't do their existing work. Hence the term disaster service worker. You know, I like to think that there is a more optimistic version of the DSW, an acronym that often gets used. These are people who are doing something wonderful rather than just being disaster service workers.
Yeah, so when we closed the libraries, they let us know that a lot of us were going to be activated as disaster service workers. I submitted an interest form just to let them know I was available. And like, I would say about 3 days later, I got an email saying, hey, would you be interested in becoming a contact tracer? And I said, absolutely, absolutely. Some of the characteristics in a person to make a good contact tracer would be, you know, somewhat tech savvy, being able to relate to people, multitask, self-managing your own time, just keeping up with the constant updates on guidelines and software. And I think, for, you know, in my experience, like librarians are a perfect match just because in our day job, we already are interacting with the community every day. We're already doing reference interviews, for instance, and trying to get to the bottom of what they need. We already do outreach. We already connect people with resources, and we know how to create that rapport with the community because we do that every single day.
We were trying to think of how many people we would need, like if the epidemic was 100 cases a day or 200 cases a day, or heaven forbid 500 cases a day. And what does that really mean to staff, and how many managers do you need, and team leads do you need, and shifts do you need? Like, it was really intense, you know, and then bringing people into that intensity and kind of being like, welcome, you're entering the unknown. And what I've just been so heartened by is, like, not only did they come along for the ride, they shaped it. You know, like Aransas and his colleagues from the, you know, that how all become team leads, like they took what we had available and they upped the ante, like every aspect of it. They were like, oh, that seems nice, but like, how about we do it this way and this much faster and with like these bells and whistles. And now like we've built something that's been replicated, and you know, we train state workers and it's been replicated at a national scale. Like, it's just unbelievable the pace that this has gone from, like a bunch of people just trying to make, you know, the situation and what was handed to them better. Really been a privilege of a lifetime to kind of see that play out in real time.
Talk a little bit about the national scale, since you mentioned it. I think we know that San Francisco's public health department, and you know, from the city level, was pretty proactive at the very start of the pandemic, but that isn't necessarily true of the rest of the country. Do you know sort of what is happening in terms of contact tracing nationwide?
I think there are 7 states that have gotten a contact tracing workforce of the level that the CDC are recommending. And their recommendations are informed by population density, et cetera. But the vast majority of states have not been able to scale a contact tracing program for a number of reasons. I think one is that departments of public health have been chronically underfunded for many years, and there is both lack of resources and then a lack of technical capacity to be able to stand up a program. I think there are some models where this is working really effectively outside of San Francisco. So I think Maryland has similarly done a really good job, and New York City as well have moved very quickly to mobilize a workforce of, I think, several thousand contact tracers. But unfortunately, you know, the vast swathes of the U.S. have not moved fast on contact tracing. And I think as seeing the sequelae of that, you know, given that they don't have the sort of the infrastructure to be able to control the disease.
Yeah. This is something that I also wanted to ask a little bit more about. In a previous episode of this mini-series about global health and COVID-19, we talked a little bit about how contact tracing is not a new concept. It's something that's been, you know, used with great success to get a handle on a whole variety of epidemics, perhaps most notably the TB epidemic. Is there anything that you wanted to add about sort of maybe why it feels so new here when it's something that's been so practiced elsewhere?
Well, I think there's a couple of like epidemiological characteristics of COVID that sort of inform why contact tracing is so different now compared to other diseases. One is that like the speed of transmission. And as I mentioned before, that, you know, the fact that this disease can move very quickly through a population, you know, every 5 days, another round of replication, et cetera. And then the second is the scale, that the fact that this is a disease that can impact and infect so many people so quickly demands a workforce of a magnitude that, you know, we haven't needed to consider for other diseases. But yeah, I mean, I think there are many great examples of where contact tracing has been leveraged highly effectively to control diseases.
I also wanted to ask a little bit more about the resources that the state or city or county provide for people to appropriately quarantine when they are contacted for contact tracing. That's actually not something I knew anything about, and I think it would be good to let people know that, you know, it's not just forcing people to randomly quarantine without any support.
up until about a week ago, the city of San Francisco was able to offer a reasonable sum of money to individuals that were infected cases so that they are able to isolate, I think $1,400 for the period that they needed to isolate. That money is now run out. So I think there's an important need to lobby local government to re-up those funds, because I think they're absolutely critical. We should be providing more resources for the most vulnerable within our society, given that, you know, we're asking them to carry the biggest burden in the COVID moment. And, you know, we should be outraged that like billionaires like Jeff Bezos have made billions of dollars during the last few months, right? And yet he runs an internet grocery store that could provide resources to all of our contacts and cases so that they could safely isolate and quarantine. And I think like the absence of like big philanthropy to make a substantial difference in this moment is tragic. And you know, I have sort of fairly modest expectations of what our federal government is willing to do as well. And I, you know, and that those two things make me quite sad, because there is an opportunity to really like radically rethink how we support the most vulnerable members of our society in this moment. And I don't think we've done enough. Despite all that we've done, and despite the fact that I think San Francisco is doing a hell of a lot more than elsewhere, you know, we should be outraged by the lack of philanthropy and funding to support, you know, folks to isolate or quarantine.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is an even deeper issue with the philanthropy model, right, is it depends on individuals to, yeah, but that's a bigger question about the role of government and what has or hasn't been done to support people.
Can I just add one of the aspects that sometimes we don't talk about as often is the access to mental health. So we have resources to provide that. For instance, emergency psychiatric services. We have the comprehensive crisis services. We have the psychiatric emergency services available. We have the San Francisco Suicide Prevention Hotline available as well. And just speaking to just family members throughout the country, I've noticed that in other places, the lack of such services, and it's not just mental health access services, but just in general, it doesn't compare to what we have here. Yes, but I think philanthropists could do more everywhere, not just here.
So to hear that there's at least something here to support quarantine is good. Do you think that the contact tracing structure in terms of being in touch with people will help facilitate things like vaccine distribution once that's developed?
My hope is that like we're building something sustainable that will have an impact beyond this moment. And so, yeah, in the short term, I think there's a great opportunity to sort of promulgate vaccine promotion activities, and whether they're related to influenza in the very short term, because we want to get everybody vaccinated to get influenza and then maybe a COVID vaccine. But I think then the other thing is like we're potentially mobilizing a cohort of community health leaders outside of the Department of Public Health who could have substantive impact. I'm really hopeful that this is an opportunity for us to kind of rethink how community health is done more generally, and how we can leverage community health workers who are doing contact tracing now across the city to do other health promotion related activities. And I think people will see that like at a societal level, there is a profound dividend from like investing in public health. Whilst COVID, I hope, goes away, I hope that some of the investment isn't redirected elsewhere at the end of all this.
Yeah, definitely. That any of you would specifically like to discuss a little bit?
One thing I would say is around like technology and exposure notification applications, contact tracing applications, which I think some people have thought of as like the solution to this problem. And I think, you know, our strong sentiment and emerging evidence suggests that actually you need human contact. You need people like Ramses and Jess and I to get on the phone and speak to you and offer compassion. And a Bluetooth-enabled application on your phone isn't going to offer that. I think like my other lens for thinking about this is that, you know, this is not the last coronavirus pandemic that we will see in the US. And I think climate change and urbanization and zoonotic spread of other diseases will probably lead to more pandemics with increasing frequency in the coming years. And I think we can learn lessons now to prepare us for those. And I think some of those lessons include investing in public health infrastructure so that we're better able to anticipate and respond to those pandemic threats coming down the pike in, you know, 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Just want to share that this has been a like life-changing experience, really. Just the scale of things and the collective effort it's taken to, you know, take on the spread of the virus. It's impressive. It's impressive. And as Mike said, I think it won't be the last time, but we will be better prepared, I think, in the future. And not just in terms of knowledge and how, but also I hope we can develop some kind of collaboration, not just, you know, in a city, but like what we are learning is something we can share with others, and we can assist in other places of the country and even globally. All librarians I speak to, it's just a life-changing experience, and I hope that what we have learned can positively impact future efforts, not just here in the country, but, you know, globally.
One of the most like unlikely things that I would have ever imagined to come out of this time is like how many people I feel close to in this community that I never would have had the fortune to meet, let alone work alongside, from DPH to all of the other contact tracers. We talk about, you know, what success looks like. And for me, down the line, if we've been able to do our job well, success looks like having a huge party in the park, you know, Golden Gate Park, and inviting like all the people that I've been on Zoom calls and been, you know, on these endless draining, you know, trainings, you know, and we're all just gonna like have a toast and be able to just say like thank you and give each other big hugs. And it's so silly, but like that is honestly what keeps me going, is just this vision of being able to like come together and appreciate one another for all that we've collectively put into this time.
Yeah, that's kind of beautiful. Well, thank you all so much for all your time and all the work that you're doing. It's, you know, obviously really essential. And I've learned so much talking about it.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Lovely to chat.
Wonderful. It's so nice to have an optimistic take on what the future holds as we all try to brace COVID-19. I certainly hope you learned a lot from Ben's conversation with Ramses Escobedo, Jess Celentano, and Mike Reed. If you'd like to learn more about contact tracing efforts at the Institute of Global Health Sciences, be sure to check out the links in our show notes for more information on contact tracing and the resources that are available for people impacted by the pandemic. This episode was produced by Stella Balanwu, Maggie Colton, and Ben Mansky, with help from the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. Thank you so much to Ramses Escobedo, Jess Celentano, and Mike Reed for their time. Special thanks to the Institute of Global Health Sciences for partnering with us to provide this content, and of course, to you, for listening. This episode wouldn't have been possible without the enormous, generous support of our Patreon supporters. So I'd like to thank this episode's science producers, Sama Ahmed, Carly Van Orsdell, Janine Cuevas, Samantha Okona Esselman, and David Cabral, for supporting us financially through our Patreon. If you'd like to support us by donating as well, you can head over to patreon.com/carrytheone. We have Patreon rewards at every support level, and we're grateful for any amount of support. You can also share our podcast with everyone you know and leave us a review. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and start a conversation. With that, have a beautiful day and stay curious.